Hi, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Media Voices. I'm your host, Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston. Later in this episode, you'll be hearing from Grace Harrison. Grace is one of the co-creators of Foul Play, an indie mag devoted to true crime, but not the kind of blood up the walls kind of true crime, much classier than that, just as you'd expect from an indie mag.
Before that, though, the news. And some of this does feel a little bit criminal to me as well, because administrators have said a single party has reached an agreement to enter an exclusivity period with Unilad. Now, this is believed to be Lad Bible. And as we spoke about last week, there's been some, let's say, backstage shenanigans about how this all actually came to pass.
So allegedly.
So where are we now with this?
Well, the bio was supposed to be revealed on Friday, but that's just kind of gone up. Sort of the status has been set to imminently, so probably by the time this episode goes out, we'll know who it is. Thanks, guys. But there have been a lot of people, some of the other parties, like Daily Mail and The Social Chain, who've also been involved in the process, have kind of called it manifestly unfair, which, based on what we were saying last week, isn't entirely surprising.
Is it not entirely surprising because of who the parties involved actually are here? This is like a who's who of people you don't want to get stuck in a lift with, really.
I saw this one comment that where they're complaining about the bidding process. Some guy at one of the agencies, he says, "We feel like we had our pants pulled down." It was like classic Unilad bants going on here.
That's how you describe something that happens in the office every other day, you know? Yeah, it's bizarre. But Lad Bible has emerged as, say, the front runner, and, you know, maybe the only real runner, which is, if you look at kind of the omnipresence of these two brands together, would make them far and away the biggest publisher on a month-to-month basis on Facebook.
It's quite scary, though, because there were figures released this week, and for the last couple of months, it's been Unilad and AdBible, like, well at the top of the social publishing chart.
Yeah,
they're constantly, like, swapping over and jostling for top spots. So if you combine that, like, literally nobody else stands a chance.
No, it is terrifying. I was looking at the figures, and it's between the two of them, they have something like, Jesus Christ, something like 60 million publishers ranked by, you know, total likes, shares and comments, which is, that would put them far and away above the third, like power gap, a huge distance between them and Fox News, which only reaches around 28 million. So that is, that is terrifying.
And in terms of the video market as well, Unilad, I think September they had 1.4 billion monthly video views. So if you think, that's Unilad. Lad Bible is fairly similar. So if you combine those two figures, that's the viewing figures on those are absolutely crazy. They might even make some money out of video.
No, don't be crazy.
What's really terrifying is if there's an alien somewhere looking at the social reach charts and they're going, okay, hold on, what this species is what? So Lad Bible's second and Unilad's first and Fox News, yeah, nuke them. Get them out of this universe. Take them out, guys.
Hey, but hang on, Peter, because according to Newswhip, the BBC is the 6th most popular publisher on Facebook.
You just mentioned the power gap.
This is just what, the birth of the super lad?
Without getting too heavy, I do think it says something about the type of content people are looking for on social media.
Yeah,
I'm not saying that humanity only ever reads daft nonsense, but on social media, I think they predominantly read daft nonsense.
It was only last year, right, that Facebook, or maybe it was this year, in fact, that Facebook said, right, well, we're changing our algorithms now that we're focusing on time well spent. So the time you spend with publishers is going to be time well spent. And then you look at the people who are at the top of the rankings and just think, is it? Yeah, but is it though? As Esther mentioned, this might actually be out of date by the time this episode goes live tomorrow, which is the Monday. So we'll keep you up to speed about what happens next week. In the meantime, though, Johnston Press is up for sale. Now, Johnston is one of the biggest regional publishers in the UK. It owns titles including The Eye Newspaper, The Scotsman and The Yorkshire Post, as well as over 200 regional newspapers. Recently, though, it's become, and I quote, bogged down in negotiations with bondholders over a £220 million refinancing due in June that it can't afford, and that's according to The Guardian.
I was quite surprised by this. There were a lot of media people that didn't seem to be surprised, but I just thought because The Eye was doing so well that this wouldn't really be such a problem for them, but apparently
The Eye's a real drop in the bucket, though, when it comes to their actual total operations. And, you know, they did buy The Eye almost to complete that national to local network that they were really promoting.
But the Johnson Press is actually profitable.
Mm.
That's the sad thing about this. I don't know if I read this piece right, but I read somewhere that they've got margins of 20%.
Mm. Mm.
So this is a debt problem. This is about being what you used to in the bad old days called over leverage, and probably still do. I mean, it's just they've got too much debt.
I mean, the Guardian suggested that they've basically invested too much when the ad boom was happening, and that then crashed as Facebook and Google came in. They've just not been able to kind of get rid of any of that.
Yeah, I don't know what were they investing in, though? Because it wasn't people.
So apparently, Johnson Press made a string of acquisitions before the arrival of Google and Facebook. And they made those acquisitions when the newspaper advertising market was worth £2.7 billion. And by the end of 2019, it'll be worth £700 million. So that's
Johnson Press used to be... there's a Francois Nell, who I think's at Lancaster. Anyway, Francois posted this link last week to a piece from 2006 in The Independent, basically saying how Johnson Press is the shining, amazing example of a regional publisher. I think it's actually an interview with Ray Snoddy. And it's like... You know, they've got margins of 35%, they're growing, they're doing this amazing stuff. It's on the stock market and it's going nuts, and the share price has gone insane from the whole value of the company's tripled over a couple of years. And it's like, it's this amazing story. And then, you know, here we are a decade and whatever later. This story, I think, says the peak, this story in 2006, it was worth something like 65 million. And now it's worth what, Chris? 3 million?
That is an awful figure.
The other thing that's changed in that time is that the circulation of UK regional and local titles has halved from 2.2 million to 1.1 million. So you've got that massive drop. Like, I don't know how much of this is... I don't know how much Johnson Press could have done about this, because it seems just been an absolute punch in the gut.
That's so spot on. You know, everyone's kind of... Or not everyone, but a lot of people blame Google and Facebook for this. Yeah, okay, there's a competition thing there, but... Was this coming anyway? You know, from a regional press point of view, the readership, it's a different game. And these companies, so Johnson Press started in whatever, 17 bloody blah, some guy in Falkirk printing stuff. And then over 300 years, they've turned it into this national organization with papers everywhere. And they're trying to talk about national scale and local scale. And it's all about scale at a Facebook type level.
Mm.
Maybe what people need to start doing is forgetting that and getting back to local newspapers. If Johnson Press is profitable, then maybe every local newspaper can find some level of profitability. I don't know, but it's not working at scale, and debt is not the way to go with it.
I think it's telling if you look at what's happening between UK regional and local titles and what's happening in the US, where they do, you know, they're all subject to the kind of the predations of Google and Facebook in terms of, you know, where people are choosing to get their news. In the US, they've actually dealt with it by diversifying a lot more. They've become much more about service journalism and becoming a point of information, almost like a very specialized local Google. Whereas in the UK, yeah, sure, they're not responsible for this, but they didn't necessarily reevaluate what the role of a local paper is in, you know, the new digital age, as the US papers have done.
Yeah, definitely. I think the best person ever to listen to on this one's Neil Thackeray. The bile that he pours on regional newspapers, not Johnson Press specifically, but any regional newspaper group, where he can't even find his local football team's times or whatever. He's scathing about the way this kind of stuff's been handled.
Trinity Mirror Reach, or whatever they're called now. Their regional websites are among the worst I've seen for adverts, probably in the entire UK.
Hey, well, speaking of Reach, it's likely that they're going to want to snap up the eye here, because they did initially express some interest in buying it. But it's reached this point now where the eye and the Scotsman are probably worth more together than the rest of the portfolio, you know, put together. So are we going to see a kind of breakup of titles here?
Well, the Johnson Press CEO himself says that regional papers are due for a consolidation. So he's obviously thinking that way. You can talk about all the debt and all the VCs and all the leveraging you want. At the end of the day, this is people's jobs again. It's just such bullshit.
Yeah.
If I saw another quote, you know, another classic, lions led by donkeys. I'm not sure that regional journalists are necessarily all lions, but there's definitely a lot of donkey stuff going on here.
So moving on then, Snapchat is launching some original shows. Snap Originals are going to be the first slate of a dozen serialized original shows, including scripted series and docuseries. This feels a lot like what a lot of other video platforms were trying to do this time last year that didn't work out for them.
Yeah. I think the difference with this is that they're planning on writing and shooting these exclusively for the app, which basically translates to vertical video. They also want to put like AR lenses and some of the other Snapchat features in them. What I found really baffling is that these shows, and you know, they're going to do like romance, horror, drama, all the things you'd normally expect from original shows. So you think, what, 20 minutes, half an hour, 40 minutes? No, these shows are going to be 5 minutes long. And I'm just kind of thinking, what can you get into? I really don't get this one.
Because it's October, I've been watching a lot of horror. How the hell could you do effective horror in 5 minutes?
I don't even feel qualified to comment on this story. I really don't.
Well, one thing is absolutely true is that Snapchat has identified here that younger people are watching a lot more video content on their phones. If you look at where the consumption habits are going, it's all going to digital video on mobile. And so Axios has said that this is a larger push by Snapchat to get the youth watching TV quality video daily on their phones, kind of forming a new type of daily video habit. This is only anecdotal, but I suspect that daily video habit already exists. It's just not taking place on Snapchat.
But what I don't understand about this is there's a lot of like Facebook Watcher chasing this kind of thing as well. You know, the short sort of original video series. I have yet to have any of those kind of water cooler discussions to work. That's like, oh, did you see this amazing video online or like on social that was this great video series? And you've got to tune into this. There's no bodyguard style stuff that's come out of this. And I think that's just because you've just not got the time to kind of really grip the audience in the same way. I mean, yeah, maybe I'm just biased against 5 minute videos, but I don't think 5 minutes is enough.
No, I think no, you're right.
But that
you can't call it a show if it's 5 minutes long.
It's a skit.
But you talk about water cooler moments. People have water cooler moments over 2 minute long YouTube videos of people falling off stuff.
That's like a cat video. That's not like a series.
But why can't that work for this? I can't believe I'm defending Snapchat video.
I think that a lot of the appeal of those type of videos is that they are unscripted, whereas the scripted shows have to be held up to a much higher standard than UGC.
I don't know, man. It's a weird one.
I don't know if you could do, you know, baby monkey riding on a pig as a weekly thing where the baby monkey rides a different animal. I mean, you know what? That said, I would definitely watch it.
Could we get funding for that?
I think what's difficult about this is that there's been so little released about what the subject of this will be. And I don't have Snapchat, so I can't even watch Snapchat. But the person who has revealed a lot about what they're going to be doing with their 10 original shows for Instagram TV is Meredith. They're going all in on Instagram's TV format. And they've kind of given some examples, which I think is a bit more helpful. So they've said, you know, their Parents magazine will have a show starring celebrity mums. And their Eating Well magazine will have a vegan cooking show. Travel and Leisure will have an air travel show starring Instagram influencers. Gosh, that's hard. And that kind of gives me a bit more detail about what they might expect. But I also don't think these are 5 minutes. I think these are a little bit longer.
Yeah, that is a hell of a brave investment to make, considering how, you know, young that actually is.
Considering they're cutting 4,500 jobs, yes.
But you also, to be fair to them, that you definitely need a strong stable right out the gate when you launch something like this, because otherwise people aren't going to come back. But that's not...
So I think Snapchat said elsewhere that the key thing about serialized stuff is that you can... It's much easier to sell advertising on. So they're going to do these six-second ads. And I think if you've got something that's regular and something that's consistent and you don't know if the cat video is going to go viral or not, but you know you've got a stable audience for these five-minute videos, it's a much more attractive monetization opportunity.
Yeah, this is going to be one of those make-or-break things, I think. If the content creators don't see some really quick... a return on investment here, you're going to see a tail off, and that's going to be the end of the platform as a whole.
This week I spoke to Grace Harrison from true crime magazine Philplay. We spoke about how she manages the magazine as a side hustle, that age-old question of whether there's anything mainstream magazines can learn from independents, and first off, what makes Philplay different from other true crime magazines?
So Foul Play is the first female-led, non-sensational true crime magazine. It's the only... true crime magazines aren't a new thing, and there are plenty of them around, but we wanted to make something that was different. We wanted to make something that looked beautiful, was non-sensational, and was the kind of thing that we would want to read ourselves.
I'm really interested in that female-led part.
So we initially never led with that, really. We were just two people that, you know, launched a magazine. We used to work at a literary magazine, and we basically found that we were going for the same books on the shelf, which were true crime books. And then Emma used to come in like 2.5 days a week. She's a freelancer. And then we kind of decided to do this like true crime desk book club. That was the original idea. And then it just spiraled out of control really quickly.
You mean in the office? Just
in the office, we were going to read a book.
All right.
And then we were going to talk about it when Emma was in. But as these things do, it kind of spiraled out of control quite quickly. And then we were like, because, you know, we were saying, well, there's been such a change in true crime in the way that it's become more acceptable to be into it, because what's being created is actually taking a turn, you know, to being a lot higher quality. So higher quality, like the podcasts, obviously, were kind of leading the way, but the TV and the film stuff, so stuff like Making a Murderer, The Jinx, all of this kind of really high quality television kind of made it seem more acceptable for other people to be into it, I think. But books now, so in my day job I work in book publishing, and there's definitely a change where there are higher quality contemporary true crime books kind of breaking through, so things like I'll Be Gone in the Dark. Anyway, so we thought, well, there must be like an indie magazine doing this already, like let's buy it. And then we couldn't find it, and then we were like, well, maybe we should do it. And then we came up with a name super quickly, and we were like, yeah, that name's amazing. We made a website. And it just kind of spiraled out of control. From there to actually us having our first issue out took a while. But the female-led thing, we never thought was interesting until we started getting press coverage and people started saying, well, it's a feminist true crime magazine, or it's a female-led true crime magazine, and that making it different. And then we kind of realised that actually it is, because so much of true crime is, it was always quite like salacious, female victim kind of, sort of suggestive looking and dead, do you know what I mean? So we've kind of gone with that a bit. I wouldn't say it's less, well, I don't know, the feminist true crime magazine. It's just we're just making a true crime magazine that's trying to be respectful, but also cover like a whole range of subjects, so not just serial killers.
But do you think the audience, your audience particularly, is female? Is that got anything to do with that side of it?
So they are. Not 100%, but we're seeing that it's like maybe 70% women.
Right.
But there are loads of women who are really interested in true crime. We actually spoke to Stylist magazine, it came out this week, where they were asking us why women love cold cases.
Yeah.
And it was actually a really interesting question. And I think that there's a few reasons. Like, there's an empathy thing, was one of the things I said. Like, I feel like women really empathise with victims, victims' families, etc. There's, for lots of people that have told us, that there's a self-preservation thing.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah, so for me and Emma, maybe not, but lots of people say, well, I listen to these podcasts, and then I realise that if this happened to me, this is what I would do. And there was a woman who was being attacked, I think it was in July, in America, and she, when the police talked to her, they were like, so what did you do? And she was like, well, I fought back because that's what I learned on My Favourite Murder, my favourite true crime book. So there's different reasons, I think, why we're...
So that practical how-to aspect.
Yeah, so there are lots of reasons, but it does seem to be women.
But also I think, I mean, it's part of that, this quality of the non-salacious aspect to the content. Quality is such a kind of loaded term, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The idea that it's not sensationalist, does that play more to that empathetic audience?
I would say so. What we're trying to, like, we have quite like a strong... a manifesto, I guess, with the magazine,
right,
where we're saying that, you know, we're not publishing any cover, any not just cover, but any images of any serial killers.
Yeah, yeah.
Trying to look at things from a different angle, because there are these same things that get brought up every time. So if you look at, and I'm not going to slag off other magazines, but other true crime magazines, you know, we just didn't really, and I think that there are other people like us who just didn't want to be sat on the bus reading something with a big picture of
Dead bodies or
also we felt that lots of these stories have already been told. So when we're doing things, we're covering, I mean, some of the things are serial killer related. We're trying to look at things from a different angle, but we're also trying to cover a whole range of different crime things, which I don't think has been done before. So crime is a huge, varied subject. So, for example, in our second issue, we had like a crimes against nature theme.
Right, yeah.
So we had a photo story about botanical theft from Kew Gardens, although the photos couldn't actually be taken at Kew Gardens, so they're taken somewhere else. But the story's about...
Fake news!
Fake news! We also did this story about a guy who... it's the greatest natural history heist of all time. So a guy who stole all these bird pelts from the Natural History Museum, this flute prodigy, now an episode of This American Life. Foul play, so we're using all of the words we can.
Fantastic.
yeah, another one, a story, this is vaguely nature-themed, but a guy who collected... 8,000 drug baggies in one town to try and show one town's problem with the drugs in Chicago, but he's made it into art. So these are all things that you wouldn't necessarily think of when you think of true crime.
So it's just broad. It's looking at everything that you can think of through the lens of crime.
Through the lens, but also like trying to recognise that there's a human aspect involved in all levels. So. It's not always just good guy, bad guy.
Right.
And we're just trying to be really, really respectful, because there's this quote which I've mentioned a couple of times, and we talked about it in our event, which you can talk about, but this thing of if you're choosing to consume someone else's tragedy kind of as entertainment, you need to be really, really respectful about either what you choose or what you create.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because
it kind of does,
you know... It is someone else.
No, it's definitely true. I mean, that's an old Dead Kennedy song. Holidays in Cambodia, isn't it? It's the same ethos as
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're on issue 3.
Yeah.
You've got 1 and 2 out there in the big bad world.
Yeah.
You've obviously been successful to a point, whatever that is, because you're doing issue 3. How's it different? What's different, the expectations that you went into it with? Did you have any expectations?
So we didn't have really any expectations. When we first started it was just me and Emma, and we thought, well, this would be fun. And we didn't really think that anyone would be interested in it. The plan was that we launched it around July last year, with the idea that the first issue was going to be in October. And I mean, we were nowhere near it. The first issue actually came out in January. But when we first did it, we were sat on that first issue for so long. I think it was Boxing Day, and we were all sat messaging each other. And I was like, just send it. Let's just, you know, like, it's fine. It's not perfect. No one's going to notice it anyway. So just do it, and then we can fix it for issue 2. So we did that, and then people did notice it. We got some kind of good press coverage early on.
Yeah, you did get, you got...
Yeah, we did an interview for Vice, which then got syndicated into the kind of US and Canada, which was the main thing. And then people started noticing it. We did a piece for Stylist. It was this kind of press coverage that then it grew, but we did such a small print run to start with that we kept selling out.
Blew up the print run.
Yeah, but when we did it, we were like, well, you know, we're not going to try and raise money to do this. We didn't do a Kickstarter. Emma before had made a magazine called Spine, which is a book cover design magazine.
Yeah.
And she was like, well, no one needs to know how many we print. Like, we can just, you know, we can just open for pre-orders. The pre-orders can then pay for the first print run. So we did that. Didn't think anyone would be interested. And then we kept selling out. So issue 1 kept selling out.
So you paid for the print run off of pre-orders?
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
So we've never spent any money on that.
And then did you reprint?
Yeah, so that's what's been harder. So
it's an expensive way to do it, isn't it?
So this is the thing. So the good things that we just said, right, we're going to do it, then we did it. I basically got everyone I knew to kind of pre-order. And then the pre-order paid for the printing run. But with a margin that's so small. This is the problem that we now face, where to grow and to scale it becomes a lot harder. Yeah. So we, in one way, were just able to do it, said we were doing it, did it, have never had to, you know, other than like we've spent a little bit of money on like a domain name or hosting, we've never really had to raise any money. The problem that we had with the first issue is that we would then get some press coverage, we would sell out again, then we'd have to use all the money that we had to then do a new print run with these magazines that cost £8 for people to buy and probably cost us about £7.50 to make
and mail.
So we had that problem with issue one, and then we did a bigger print run for issue two to try and bring down the cost. The thing with it is that with the first issue we couldn't have stockists. We've now got a problem where people keep messaging us saying, when are you going to reprint issue one? Because I'm a completist and I don't want to buy issue two without having it. But at the moment, it's like, well...
But so you know what you should do, though? I can't remember what the... It was a cycling magazine who, years after they'd been going and it was really successful, they found a box of first editions
in
the loft
and
stuck them on eBay. got very wealthy.
So, kind of your question about our expectations, it exceeded our expectations in people being interested in it. We knew that we would be into it. We didn't know how many other people would kind of think. I think there were a lot of people that feel that they want to read something about true crime, but they didn't feel that there was something that they would feel comfortable buying. Yeah. That's what it's like. So it's exceeded expectations. It's been great, and... You know, we're super, super happy with where it is at the moment.
So do you feel like you got the message across that it was something different?
Yeah.
And the press was part, you know, the press you got from Vice or whoever was part of that?
Exactly. I think because there's a mixture of things. I think there's one thing that people are saying true crime is having a thing.
Mm.
And every time there's a new thing, so there'll be...
Third series of serials just going out.
Yeah, the water-cooler kind of true crime thing reignites the interest. But also, it wasn't very hard to make clear that it was different, because I think it's strange. Everything looks hideous, almost, in true crime stuff.
Yeah,
it was...
It's almost got a 1950s thing going on about it, hasn't it? Like those pulp novels.
It makes you feel like you want to wash your hands. It's very easy to make something that's clearly different. Obviously now there are more high quality things around, but it instantly, just us not having a person on the cover makes it instantly different. So that, in terms of the magazine thing, wasn't hard. I found that with the design of it, we've tried to go for something in between a kind of commercial looking magazine and something high-end, arty, conceptual, because everything that's currently created for true crime, we couldn't, you know, veer too far away.
Yep.
We wanted to make something that looks like...
People wouldn't have known it was a true crime publication.
I mean, we've had some help. There's a guy that's been helping us called Morgan Rees, who has been kind of invaluable support in just teaching us how to make magazines.
Yep. How did you come across him?
From the PPA.
Oh, wow.
So basically people that, from working at the PPA, has been invaluable in terms of meeting people. So he's kind of been helping us teach us how to make magazines. So that's why the magazine has like a three-part structure. So we've got the front section, the middle section, and the back section.
Classic bell curve.
Huh?
Classic bell curve.
So it resembles, it kind of sits...
That's so interesting, though, because that means that... You basically made this great mag, because I've read it, and you know, I wrote for the first one, and it's brilliant. But you've come at that from a position of fundamentally not knowing, how to make a magazine, and done a brilliant job, and now you're working backwards through some of these theories. Yeah. I love that idea.
Both of us, we'd never really... I mean, I've worked for magazines, but I worked in events, you know, I'm not... This is the first time I created a magazine. I always wanted to work in magazines, but could never find a job that I wanted. And then we realised that you could just make it the job that you want.
Oh, so, brilliant.
And now what's really interesting is that you have to do all of the different things.
So, all the annoying stuff.
No, but like I've learned so much. Like now I know about, well, we haven't done it yet, but subscriptions kind of stockists and paper.
Housekeeping.
And printing. Housekeeping. I work in PR now, so that's been helpful for the magazine in a way. It's really, really interesting.
Just bringing it all together.
So
you, this is a side hustle then?
Yeah, this is a side hustle.
You've got a real day job.
I've got a real day job. I work in book publishing in my day job.
Right.
As a book publicist.
How did you find merging or keeping those two things going?
It's hard, but my work, so I work for a company called Palettement, and they're so supportive of what, you know, of the magazine. I started working with more crime authors, which has been really interesting. They've been super, super supportive. I mean, I do it in my spare time. We meet every Wednesday. That's been one of the key things. And that's one of the things where if we don't do it, stuff doesn't happen. But we all work remotely. There are kind of four or five of us that sort of work on it now. Again, everyone's got full-time jobs. So we all work on it remotely. We do it. We just live by a Dropbox, really.
Yeah.
And this WhatsApp group and the meeting. And then there'll be times when there'll be times when we do loads and we see each other a lot, and there'll be times when we don't. We now meet and spend the weekend before we go to press working at Emma's so that we can all go through the pages, make sure that everyone's happy with them, send it off feeling like we've all seen it, etc. And then we go and go to the pub.
Get hammered.
Yeah. So it
celebration.
Yeah. So that spending time together, when we do get to be in the same room, we get so much more done. But one of the problems that we face, I think, is wanting to do everything.
Yeah.
And there's so much potential we see, and we really want to do a podcast. We really want to do that.
We
really want to do, you know, a newsletter. But then the problem is that if we don't deliver the magazine on time, then that should be the core thing.
So you've got to make choices.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just have to be super creative when you're doing everything for free.
Yeah.
So, for example, me working as a book publicist made me realise that you can get content from authors, good writing for free because they want to publicise their books.
Yep.
So that's been a way that we can also, like, anyone that I know who's a writer helping us, we've had to be really creative with how we get our imagery because we can't pay any photographer, it's, so everything takes longer. If we could just commission pieces, we're relying on the kindness of strangers.
Okay, but one of the themes that we get regularly about indie magazines, what can mainstream publishers learn from independent publishers? Yeah. What do you think they can learn? Anything?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we're able to produce these things in our, in our spare time. I feel like if we had the time put aside, we could, we could do a great job on these things. Well, we could progress it faster, I think. But the thing that I think that you could learn is the flexibility and everyone kind of getting involved in different areas.
Yeah.
I mean, the things that we've all had to learn, like me and Emma have both had to learn.
Right. The one question we ask every interview that we do is, what was the last piece of media that you read or watched or participated in that really made a difference to you?
Okay, so it would be, I've been telling everyone to read it. It's the piece for New York Times magazine called Losing Earth. It was by Nat Rich. It's quite a long piece. But it's called Losing Earth, the Decade We Could Have Saved the Planet. And it is about the period between, I think, 1978 and 1988, when basically people knew as much as they did about climate change as they do now. But it's just terrifying. It's so nicely done. So the way they've done the website, you scroll through and you see these images, they're like full screen images. then show that, you know, show the damage that we've been doing right. to the environment. It's super terrifying. It's really beautifully done. Brilliant. It's called Losing Earth.
So don't forget, you can check out our back catalogue of previous speakers at voices.media. And we also regularly publish links to our media-related work elsewhere, just to prove we are, well, we do sort of know what we're talking about, except blockchain. Additionally, you can keep in contact with us at Media Voices Pod on Twitter or by following us individually.
And you can sign up to our newsletter. Yeah, we've got a newsletter. Did we mention it? It'll show you what we're reading. It'll tell you what we thought about the interviews that we did, even though I haven't written that yet. It has links to all the stories we talked about this week. And actually, in a busy news week like this week, it'll also have links to the stories that we didn't get to. We'll put a quote of the week in there. If you're already on the list, tell other people. Send it to someone else. Do them a favour. Do us a favour.
But until next week, when we're going to be back with another absolutely fantastic guest, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Ta-ta.